It's been a rough start to the week for global markets. The reasons why tell us a lot about what's ahead for the global economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, September 26th. Good to have you with us. The past 2 weeks on global financial markets have been brutal, and today was no exception. Here in the U.S., in Asia, and in Europe. And yes, I know the stock market is not the economy, but in this case, stock markets are looking at the economy and not liking what they're seeing one bit. The British pound hit a record low against the U.S. dollar. We'll hear more on that in a bit. Energy markets are indicating a recession's on the way because the price of oil has been falling, a sign of weak demand for energy. And everyone's dealing with the effects of Russia's war in Ukraine. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us started.
The global economy came out of the first 2 years of the pandemic in surprisingly good shape, considering the risks. But then supply chain problems dragged on, Russia invaded Ukraine, inflation rose, and before long, the global economy was in trouble, says Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
I guess it's the old saying for financial markets, one disaster rarely comes alone. I wouldn't call it a perfect storm, but it's getting mighty windy out there.
Global growth is at risk for a host of reasons. First, aggressive interest rate hikes aimed at dampening demand to get inflation in check, led by the U.S. Federal Reserve and followed by central banks around the world.
Rates are really moving up for the first time in 15, in some cases even 20 years, with declines across many equity markets and sort of risky assets that tend to rely on borrowed money.
Add in a big dose of international trouble and strife.
The ongoing geopolitical shock and uncertainty of the war in Ukraine, resurfacing of the threat of nuclear war. Right? Not the headlines people would like to have.
Especially in Europe, where the headlines include Russia cutting off natural gas supplies and energy prices going through the roof. Over in Asia, meanwhile, China's economy is in trouble. The U.S. is likely to weather the global economic storm better than our main trading partners, says Brad McMillan at Commonwealth Financial Network.
We are far and away the least affected by global problems. Certainly, we're not independent of the world, but we have much, much less exposure than, say, Europe or the Far East.
Just look at energy, he says. We produce most of our own. In Europe and Asia, they're dependent on Russia and the rest of the world. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, like Mitchell said, it was rough out there. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, now on to the UK. At one point today, the yield on Britain's 10-year bond, it's called the gilt, reached 4.282%. That's the highest it's been since 2008, and it means that it just got a lot more expensive for the UK government to borrow money. Meanwhile, like I mentioned at the top, the pound hit a record low against the dollar today. All said, investors suddenly are pulling their money out of Great Britain. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
The price of British bonds fell more on Friday than it has ever fallen in a day in more than three decades.
I've never seen investors really kind of push back on anything this aggressive. I mean, it's historic.
Simon Harvey is head of analysis at Monex Europe. This all erupted last week after the British government made a big announcement. It said it would help people with their soaring energy bills and cut taxes. Price tag, $225 billion.
This is the question the markets are asking. How do you pay for this?
Dan Hamilton is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. The answer?
By extra borrowing.
Extra borrowing at a time when interest rates are rising, making that extra expensive for the government. Ilaria Maselli is a senior economist with the Conference Board. She says here's what investors are thinking.
the outlook for growth has worsened. The budget deficit is huge. Interest rates are rising. So I'm less sure compared to a year ago whether the government would be able to give my money back.
So investors are not going to buy UK bonds unless they get paid more to do it. One reason bond yields have gone up so much. But it's more than just worries about debt. It's also anxiety over what amounts to schizophrenic economic policy. Andrew Molyneux is with Janice Henderson.
The tax cuts act in completely the opposite direction to what the Bank of England is trying to achieve.
There is a fear that tax cuts could fuel inflation. The Bank of England is trying to fight inflation by raising interest rates. Here's how Mohamed El Arian, chief economic advisor at Allianz, put it to the BBC.
The image of driving the car with the chancellor foot on the accelerator and the governor foot on the brake. That is not a good way to drive the UK economy.
The Bank of England could hit the brake harder, raise interest rates more, and send the UK into a recession. Or it could not. Either way, the current tug of war is not great for the UK economy, its currency, or its credibility. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Since all this market action may be affecting some folks' blood pressure, deep breaths, everyone, let's talk about health for a bit. Your doctor isn't supposed to share your health information with anyone without your explicit consent. HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, makes sure of it. The health apps on your phone, however, like the period tracker, the WebMD searches, the one you use to chart your diet or cholesterol, that's a whole different story. And while many health-related websites and apps promise that they're not transmitting any data that counts as sensitive personal information, who gets to decide what that means? Tatum Hunter is a technology writer with The Washington Post, and she's been reporting on this. Tatum, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So doctors and hospitals aren't supposed to share my medical information without my permission because of HIPAA. Why doesn't that apply here when we're talking about apps?
So the way HIPAA's set up is that certain entities have to abide by it. That might be an insurer or a doctor. But health apps aren't one of those entities. So if you are, you know, in a session with a therapist on a health app, that's likely protected by HIPAA because they're a provider. But if you're clicking around, even outside of your therapy session on a therapy app, if you fired up a symptom checker such as drugs.com, that's not protected by HIPAA, and neither is what that app learns about you.
So what kind of information is being gathered and where is it being shared?
In this case, we saw your activities inside the app, such as what pages you visited, in the case of WebMD and drugs.com, what concerns you were researching, getting paired with user identifiers that are linked to your phone, and then sent off to ad companies.
Some of this data comes from apps and that we download and willingly use, or websites that we go to on our own, and we sign off on these privacy policies, often without reading them. But in your reporting, you also found ways that our health information is shared even when we don't opt in. What does that look like?
So all of these apps have privacy policies, you know, that we accept when we use them, but we might not understand what that entails. For example, somebody who had said yes to drugs.com's privacy policy might not understand that that app is communicating with 100 plus third parties behind the scenes. So what is the user's expectation when they say, sure, yeah, you can use my information to, for example, improve your services? It's hard to really wrap your mind around those downstream effects, such as information about your health concerns potentially landing in the hands of employers, insurers, credit grantors, or government agencies. Because once information has kind of trickled out into the digital ad ecosystem, it's incredibly difficult for journalists, researchers, or especially consumers to keep track of where it lands.
All right. HIPAA is clearly not protecting all of our health information online at this point. What other protections might be out there for patients or consumers? Or is there anything in the works?
some lawmakers have identified that this is a problem and are trying to rein it in. For example, there's a California assembly member who's proposed a bill that would redefine the state's medical privacy law so that medical information includes data gathered by mental health apps. So right now, there are no good protections for this, but people are noticing it. As always, the burden kind of falls to consumers to decide what apps they want to engage with right now.
And what can people be doing now if they don't want that information shared?
So if you're using an iOS device, such as an iPhone, when you get that prompt that says, ask app not to track, go ahead and always ask them not to track you. If you're using an Android device, you can do something called resetting your Android ad ID. You can punch that into Google to figure out how. And what that does is it basically wipes clean the set of numbers that's linked to your phone so that advertisers have a harder time tracking you across the web. And recently, Google changed its policies so that you can turn off that ad ID altogether.
Tatum Hunter is a technology writer with The Washington Post. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up.
So right now we're making the little chocolate pumpkins and turkeys.
Sounds delicious, but before we snack, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 329 points today, 1.1%, to close at 29,260. The Nasdaq fell 65 points, 0.6%, to finish at 10,802. And the S&P 500 retreated 38 points, 1%, to end at 3655, a new low for the year. Checking some of the global markets Mitchell told you about, Britain's FTSE was little changed, Germany's DAX dropped 0.4%. Back stateside, the Congressional Budget Office is out with its estimate of the cost of President Biden's student loan forgiveness program. The CBO says it could be as high as $400 billion over 10 years. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.90%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate minority leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Any day now, the Tennessee Supreme Court is expected to rule on the latest appeal from a company that oversaw one of the largest toxic disaster cleanups in American history, a coal ash spill in eastern Tennessee just before Christmas almost 14 years ago. Hundreds of workers say they got sick cleaning up the radioactive sludge, a byproduct of burning coal to generate power. The contractor that oversaw the cleanup is now called Jacobs Solutions, and many workers said Jacobs denied them protective equipment on site. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more.
Ansel Clark was suffering from a blood cancer called polycythemia vera when we met at his home in 2020.
I'm not doing real well. I have real bad dizzy spells, and I stagger around a lot.
Clark was among the first workers on the scene at the Kingston Fossil Plant in 2008, when more than 5.4 million cubic yards of coal ash burst out of a holding pond belonging to the regional utility, the Tennessee Valley Authority, or TVA. Clark was a fuel truck driver and spent 5 years helping clean up the mess. He became visibly ill early on.
You get a cough, a sneeze, you get black stuff out of your nose, your eyes water, and you can't get rid of it.
The TVA hired Jacobs Engineering, now called Jacobs Solutions, to oversee the cleanup, which included dredging the coal ash from the Emory River. Clark said Jacobs didn't provide adequate safety equipment for this job and that workers were not allowed to wear their own.
They would fire you and remove you from the site for wearing dust masks. Then, after they would threaten us, then they'd tell us how safe it was. You could eat a pound of it a day.
Someone literally said those words to you?
Yes.
Clark told me those threats came from a supervisor at Jacobs, which declined to be interviewed for this story, but said in a statement that they complied with all regulatory guidelines and industry best practices during the cleanup. They also said that a significant number of plaintiffs had their medical conditions long before they started working at Kingston. Ansel Clark said he was in good health when he started working at the site, as were many of his coworkers.
47 people died that I worked with, side by side.
That was in 2020. Ansel Clark himself died last year, adding to the climbing death toll among workers. Hundreds more are sick, many, like Clark, with various forms of cancer. Coal ash, they now know, contains a slew of toxic elements.
Arsenic, selenium, lead, and others.
And radioactive elements have also been discovered at this particular spill. Avner Van Ghosh, a geochemist at Duke University, says coal ash was dangerous for cleanup workers, but can also harm communities where it's stored. His team has found evidence of groundwater contamination from coal ash at a dozen sites in the southeast.
The more we study this, we see that the impact is much wider than we previously thought.
He says coal seemed to be a cheap, available energy source.
But now we pay the price of the legacy of coal ash.
The Environmental Protection Agency didn't regulate coal ash until 2015, 7 years after the spill at Kingston. Few rules are in place to prevent another spill like Kingston's, according to Jamie Satterfield. She's an investigative journalist who's followed workers' efforts to get compensated for years.
First lawsuit was filed in 2013, and here we are in 2022, and there's still no resolution.
In 2018, a federal jury handed workers a victory by finding that Jacobs failed to exercise reasonable care to keep workers safe. A next phase, to determine if their actions made workers sick, has yet to get underway amid a barrage of appeals from Jacobs.
If they get a verdict in which a jury concludes coal ash is dangerous enough to cause these kinds of diseases, that puts every producer of coal ash on notice that they're now going to have to start telling people that it's dangerous.
Ansel Clark's widow, Janie, says those who helped in the cleanup deserve a win in court.
Ansel's passed away, but there's other workers that are all getting older, and I'm concerned that they won't be here to ever see anything happen.
At the very least, she wants people to know what happened in Kingston, because another spill could happen anywhere coal ash is stored. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
In the District of Columbia, children are required to attend kindergarten, same in 19 other states. But the state with the most school-aged children does not and won't be anytime soon. Yesterday, California Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed a law making kindergarten mandatory. Proponents say kindergarten helps close an opportunity gap, but Newsom said it would also cost the state about $268 million a year, and there just wasn't room in the budget. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
Kindergarten has changed since Fannie Roman was a student several decades ago.
So I remember nap time, snack time, and play.
Now Roman's a kindergarten teacher at a public school in New York City. Nap time's gone, the kids eat apples instead of Oreos, and even snack time has an academic component.
it's a working snack almost. Like, you know, we're either listening to a story or they're writing and eating a snack.
Roman also has time set aside just for play, but says there's pressure from the school district to meet certain reading and math targets before moving on to first grade. Kindergarten's also a key time for kids to acquire social skills, like how not to bite people they disagree with.
You know, there's the kind of old adage of everything I ever needed to know I learned in kindergarten, of course.
Max Crowley studies human development as a professor at Penn State. He says kindergarten has evolved from making kids into good workers to helping them learn how to learn.
That leads them to then get better grades, right? To be able to navigate the social system that schools are so they don't get in trouble, so that they can be successful, that they can be happy.
Crowley calls kindergarten an essential first step, one many kids have been missing. School enrollment for five-year-olds dropped by 6% in 2020 and still hasn't fully recovered. Vicki Bentley with the Homeschool Legal Defense Association says the kindergarten of today isn't right for some kids.
They have a lot of gifts in a lot of areas, but academics at this level aren't it. So they feel pressured. This affects their self-confidence. Whereas if we would just let them move at their own pace, when they're ready, they will pick that up.
Bentley says mandatory kindergarten funding should go towards educating parents about how to teach kids at home. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
We get consumer spending figures for August this Friday, plus another look at inflation via the Fed's preferred inflation measure, personal consumption expenditures, or PCE. One thing that's hard to capture in that data is that the big holiday shopping season isn't that far off. That leads me to Kristen Tallheimer Bingham, co-owner of Dean Sweets, a chocolate shop in Portland, Maine, and one of the small business owners we check in with throughout the year. Here's her fall dispatch.
We've been prepping for the holidays since about July, I'd say, trying to make as much in advance as we possibly can. So right now we're making the little chocolate pumpkins and turkeys and December holiday items like snowmen and chocolate trees and Hanukkah gelt. We have a good inventory of hot chocolate, and we're getting a jump on making the chocolate shells for our cocoa bombs, which was a very popular item from last year. One thing that stands out for me every year around midsummer is when I notice customers who start talking about holiday gifts. And it shows that we've rounded some bend in the road. Just this past week, a couple came into one of our stores and I was helping them. One of them got very excited and kind of danced around the store saying, "I found my stocking stuffers, I found my stocking stuffers," so she could check it off her holiday shopping list. So yeah, it's started. Costs have changed even in the last 2 months. Chocolate has gone up about 10 to 15%, which is a continuation of the 10 to 15% it had already gone up in the spring and early summer. To us, it seems pretty clear that this is not a short-term increase. Our butter supplier also just notified us that they've raised their prices, too. We use local butter, so the increase came with an apology, so that's something. Thankfully, staffing has not changed for us at all. Everyone will work more hours as we move into and through the fourth quarter, and we'll hire two or three more part-time people for the months of November and December. We've already got them lined up, so we're feeling good about being prepared for the busy, busy time of year that's just around the corner. At this point, we've still only raised our prices on a few items that are not our main line of products. We are really resisting price increases. Mostly we're resisting because we feel our price points encourage more sales. The fear is, of course, if we raise our prices, we'll have fewer customers. I'm sure in the end we'll have to succumb to these cost increases, but for now, we're staying with what we have.
Kristen Tallheimer Bingham, co-owner of Dean Sweets in Portland, Maine. This final note on the way out today, since we started the show talking about the British pound, another bit of UK currency news via Bloomberg. Old 20 and 50 pound banknotes made out of paper will no longer be legal tender after this month. There are some new ones in circulation made of a polymer that's more durable. So Brits have less than a week to spend or deposit the roughly 11 billion pounds of those notes that are still in circulation, which, after the pound sell-off, is worth considerably less, at least in dollars, than it used to be. Here's your moment of economic context. So remember when the Inflation Reduction Act became law, it included a 15% corporate minimum tax? Well, researchers at the University of North Carolina Tax Center looked at public data from 2021 and found if the law had been in place then, just 80 companies would have been affected. But those companies would have contributed about $32 billion in additional tax revenue. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.